Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, thanks for joining us this evening. My name is Anthony Bubalo, and I'm the Research Director at the Lowy Institute for International Policy in Sydney. It's a great pleasure to be here in Canberra to launch The Roots of Terrorism in Indonesia, From Dawal Islam to Jamaah Islamiyah, by Solahuddin, and translated by the Lowy Institute's Dr. Dave McRae. The book is, of course, an edited translation of Solahuddin's earlier best-selling Indonesian work, NII Sampai J.I. Salafi Jihadism di Indonesia. Apologies for my poor Indonesian pronunciation. I am but a mere Arabist. The book is a joint publication of New South Press and the Lowy Institute. It was also possible as a result of some financial support from the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. We have the author of the book here tonight. We have the translator of the book tonight. The one thing we don't have tonight is the book. Unfortunately, we have Australia Post to blame for that. But there are some order forms here for the book. And if you order the book through the order form, you still get the 20% discount. So I encourage you to do that. We also have some plates. So if you do want to get Sola to sign it, sign the plate, which you can then slip into the book afterwards. Again, I apologise for Australia Post's incompetence, but we hope to have that the Co-op Bookshop will have plenty of copies of the book very shortly for you to buy. I first met Solahuddin some 9 years ago when I was doing research with Greg Feely from the ANU here. On Middle Eastern Islamist connections with Indonesia. Since then, I've come to know Sola a lot better, have done some work with him in the course of very many visits to Indonesia over the years. Indeed, for a Middle East watcher, I seem to have spent an inordinate amount of time in Indonesia. And as a novice to the country, it's been extremely important to have people like Sola as a guide. We spent a lot of time talking about Middle East and Islamist politics. We learned a lot from each other. And it underlined to me how important it is for people to work across disciplines and the real value of combining two different specialisations, a specialisation in the Middle East and a specialisation of Indonesia. So when I learned that Sola's book had been published and that there were no plans to publish it in English, I jumped at the opportunity to help out. I probably jumped a little too quickly without looking, but that's the problem with being more enthusiastic than prudent. Fortunately, Dr. Dave McRae had recently joined the Institute and was foolish enough to agree to translate Sola's epic work. He's tackled it with great heroism, all 120,000 words of the original, which we've been able to boil down to something more manageable and accessible, as you see in the volume. Or as you will see in the volume before you when you eventually receive it. One of the key things that we wanted to do with this book was not just to translate it, but also to take it to a wider audience, including students. And that was one of the reasons why it was important to make it as accessible as possible. We're very proud of the result and very proud of what was a very new venture for the Lowy Institute. So let me turn now to some of our guests tonight who'll say a few words each about to help us launch the book. First, the Honourable Gareth Evans, ACQC, Chancellor of this august institution. I won't go through Gareth's bio for a couple of reasons. First, I assume you know who he is. Second, it will probably take all night. The first time I crossed paths with Gareth, he scared the living crap out of me. I was a young graduate recruit in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, 6 months in the department. I'd been plonked in my first rotation on the Africa desk, made the Ethiopia desk officer, thinking that, and no doubt the thinking was, well, if you stick him out of harm's way, you know, he can't cause any problems there. One day we received a phone call from the minister's office saying the minister was about to meet the late Fred Hollows. He needed a quick briefing on Ethiopia. So I picked up the receiver, told him who I was, Anthony Bubalo, Africa Desk. He said to me, yeah, what's this Oromo Liberation Front? Fortunately, I knew what the Oromo Liberation Front was and managed to to get through what was a very kind of scary introduction to the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. What that did underline, though, was Gareth's great attention to detail. It was a focus on detail that we certainly appreciated in the department, and I would even say eventually came to miss. So without further ado, let me welcome to the podium Gareth Evans.
Well, thanks, Anthony. I guess I should thank you for that introduction, but a lot of stories told about me in foreign affairs, and an awful lot of them are really pretty apocryphal. I think my best example of how things can take off in the wrong direction was on one occasion I wrote an annotation on a brief that I received by someone like Anthony deep in the bowels of the department. I wrote an annotation on it and sent it back, and I got a phone call a day or so later from the head of the department, Minister. Very nice of you to take the trouble of annotating our reports, but did you really have to tell a very junior member of our department to get stuffed? I said, look, frankly, I mean, I'm responsible for all sorts of things, but I don't think I've ever in my life written an annotation of that kind on a brief. Can you please bring the thing over and see what on earth you're talking about? My writing is not my best attribute, as people will know. But what I'd actually written on this particular brief was good stuff. So, but such a legend's born, I'm afraid, and such are the ones you have to live with. Listen, tonight I'm very delighted that this is something of a happy reunion for me, and a happy reminder for reasons I'll explain in just a second, of my time as president of the International Crisis Group in particular. When I discovered not only that my relevance deprivation syndrome was not a permanent condition, and that there was indeed a life after politics, but also discovered there that a recently established international NGO really could produce groundbreaking research and analysis, which really could have a major impact on government policy making. There was no work that the International Crisis Group did during the decade that I was there, from 2000 to 2009, of which I was more proud than that of our Indonesian project director, Sydney Jones, and her team, producing, alongside a number of other reports on other issues across the archipelago from Aceh to West Papua, some 20 major reports over that period on the origins, the impact, and the strategies to deal with the Jamaah Islamiyah movement. While Sydney Jones herself is a living treasure, as those of you who know her work or have heard her on the many visits here to ANU will readily agree, I'm sure that she would be the first to acknowledge that an indispensable ingredient in a great many of those reports was the absolutely extraordinary work of her close friend and colleague, Solihull, the launch of whose superb book we are celebrating this evening. Sola's worked with or for Crisis Group, either on the staff or as a consultant, for really most of the last decade. And over and again, he has produced material of extraordinary evidentiary value, extraordinary acuity, extraordinary insight, which certainly contributed hugely to the reputation that our reporting at Crisis Group rapidly acquired with relevant governments, and clearly is demonstrated in the text of the book that's before you now. The key to Sola's success as a researcher and an analyst has been extraordinary. I know I'm using that word a lot, but it really is advisedly. Extraordinary access that he was able to obtain to the most unlikely and otherwise inaccessible sources. It was not only the information he was able to extract from court and other documents that only he seemed to be able to dig up, but the almost unbelievable interviews that only he, Sola, seemed able to set up and conduct. Among those he persuaded to talk were old DI fighters who wouldn't talk to anyone in Indonesian, but open up completely to Sola when he joked with them in the local dialect. I have to say that we had some bumps along the way in this relationship, as Sola developed. for his research, relationships of real confidence with some highly dubious characters. Without those personal connections he made, he simply could not have produced, he's grinning away now, he could not have produced those rolled gold reports that he did, produced that rolled gold material. But without going into details, and I really can't, there was a tendency for some of our government agencies who benefited most from and appreciated most the Solar-derived information that we were able to supply on or off the record and often in real time, was a reluctance to believe that someone who knew that much about who was who in the Jihadi zoo and what was going on, reluctance to believe anything, that that person had to be part of the plot rather than a disinterested researcher. And that led, among other things, I have to say unhappily, to Solar at one stage being denied a visa to come to Australia and here to ANU to do a graduate degree on an Aussie scholarship that we'd negotiated, partly to get him out of the country at the very delicate and dangerous time. Well, it's a long and complicated story, and I'm rather constrained from telling you more about it, but it did have a happy ending. Solar didn't take up his scholarship in Australia, didn't get to do his degree, but he was given equivalent resources by AusAid to write this book, and by DFAT to publish it. And I think with due deference to those around here who have laboured mightily on their theses over the years, that we have here something that, for the most part, is far more original and far more useful than the great majority of dissertations turn out to be. This is the first serious history of jihadi ideology in Indonesia, showing how the Darul Islam movement, the DI movement, took the radical ideologies coming in from the Middle East in the 1970s and 80s and grafted them onto their own belief system, developed in the 1950s during the Islamist insurgency against the New Republic. Salafi jihadism wasn't just an import, that had an Indonesian base to build on. The 2002 Bali bombings were a huge shock, not just because of the terrible death toll, but because no one had really seriously believed that that an act of terrorism of this kind and this magnitude could take place in Indonesia, which was not under attack or occupation, as in Palestine, Chechnya, Kashmir, did not have an alienated Muslim minority, as in Europe, did not have a repressive government, like most of the Middle East. Solar makes clear that terrorism and the ideology that justified it was nothing new. Darul Islam had authorized attacks on civilians in West Java in the 1950s, and there'd been waves of bombings in the 1970s by some of the same people who later became active in JI. What was new was the targeting of foreigners, and that came directly from the interaction of Indonesian and radical ideologues on the Pakistan-Afghan border in the late 1980s and early 1990s. The value of this book, both to academic and policy communities, lies, I think, in, among other things, its analysis of how changes in ideological direction can affect targets and strategies, tactics and targets. The Bali bombs marked a shift in emphasis from the near enemy, so perceived, the Suharto government, to the far enemy, so perceived, the United States and its allies, including Australia. And after JI, Jamar Islamiya adopted the Al-Qaeda fatwa in 1998. This book ends with the Bali bombings. Although those of you familiar with Crisis Group's reports that I've mentioned will know something about the subsequent turns of the ideological and operational wheel, we'll have to wait, I guess, for a detailed and systematic account of this for the sequel volume that I understand Sola happily is now writing. I should say finally that part of my pleasure on this occasion, part of the nostalgia of this occasion, is to be able to acknowledge the role in making this book of Dave McRae, who's done a really quite superb job in translating the original Indonesian text and, in consultation with Sola, modifying and expanding some of it along the way to make it more accessible to non-Indonesian readers. Needless, perhaps, to say, after the build-up, Dave is yet another alumnus of the International Crisis Group, who worked for us in Jakarta in the mid-2000s, and among other things did a great job in holding the fort for us while Sydney Jones and a senior colleague got themselves into trouble with the Indonesian security authorities and were exiled for a time in Singapore. So let me conclude by offering my warmest congratulations, not only to Sola, not only to Dave for his translation, but everyone else closely associated with the appearance of this book, in particular the University of New South Wales and the Lowy Institute. It's a great addition to the literature, which all of you can be very proud of.
Thanks, Gareth. The book is the product of many people's work. Of course, Sola, the author, Dave, the translator, but as so often happens in these cases, you also have to find the money from somewhere to do the translation. Fortunately, at the time, when we were looking around for some support to do this, we had in Bill Patterson, the former Australian ambassador for counterterrorism, a far-sighted individual who understood that part of his job was not just to fly around the world signing CT agreements, it was also to help build an understanding of terrorism more broadly. And Bill was very supportive of this project from the get-go. Unfortunately, Bill is no longer with us. It's okay. He's now Australian ambassador to South Korea. But certainly, Bill deserves a lot of acknowledgement for the final product. It's also nevertheless important to acknowledge DFAT's role in this, and we have with us tonight representing DFAT, Alastair Cox, the first Assistant Secretary of the Southeast Asia Division of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. And I'd now like to invite Alastair to say a few words.
Well, thank you very much, Anthony, and to Gareth Evans, the Chancellor of ANU, and Pat Sola, to Dave McRae, to the Lowy Institute, and to ANU. Thank you very much for inviting me here today to the opening, to the launching of this unique volume. And it's a very great pleasure for me, representing DFAT, to be here today. In the lead up to this, I did get in touch with Bill Patterson, as you say, is now in Seoul. And Bill asked me tonight to pass on his very great regards to you, Sola, and to all of you here this evening, and to give you his greetings. He's very sorry he couldn't be here this evening. But in response to my question about the decision to support the translation of this volume, he said that it was a very simple call for him. He said the book was a unique insight into the history of Islamic radical terrorism, the Salafi jihadism in Indonesia since Darul Islam, and that he hoped that through the history and revealing the detailed history of the philosophy, the thinking, the forming, deforming, reforming of this organisation in its myriad forms since the 1950s, and then through to its Jamaa Islamiya in the 1990s and the 2002 Bali bombings, that it would reveal and give insights for, as Gareth said, policymakers and as a practical guide to understanding the nature of Salafi jihadism in Indonesia, and to give ideas for addressing it, for countering it, and for the ongoing struggle in understanding and addressing it through police, through political engagement, through the range of the tools we have available to us. And I think that in that aspiration for the translation of this book, that's certainly been very much realised. And I think Dave's translation of your magnificent research, Anthony's editing, has produced a book that is tremendous, not just for its depth of insight, intellectual insight, but is also written and in translation in a way that's very engaging, almost like a page turner, almost like a novel that you can read very quickly, because it has a density of content, you don't feel that density as you read through it. You just read page by page very quickly, and you get a very deep insight into Jamaat Islamiyah and its antecedents. And I congratulate all of you on that achievement, because books of that type, this sort of intellectual quality, don't always read like that, I can tell you. They often are much more turgid and hard to read and hard to enjoy. And this doesn't fit that bill at all. It's extremely readable, and I congratulate you on that achievement. I think the other thing that's important about this book is just that hidden history of Darul Islam and its antecedents in certainly in the period after 1962. I think that the Bali bombings coming as they did in 2002, in a sense, and our great surprise at that, was no surprise in the sense that they had been hidden for so long by the New Order. And I think one thing that has been revealed in this era since the beginning of this century has been an opening up of old histories and a revealing of what transpired, what was suppressed during the New Order period, and some of that is now emerging in different ways in Indonesia and in Indonesian discourse and in Indonesian writing. But the revealing of that hidden history and the way that Darul Islam and the subsequent organisations, you know, that formed and reformed, deformed and reformed again, and the way that the networks of people emerged is so valuable now to help us to address these issues in modern Indonesia. And I think this and subsequent volumes that Gareth mentioned that you're working on, and the work of the crisis, and the work too of the crisis group that Gareth very rightly mentions, does, I think, now help us not necessarily to fully defeat Salafi jihadism, but to understand how it is evolving, how it is changing, and that then allows us in a atmosphere of greater openness and transparency to deal with it much more effectively than before. And I think the history of suppression, control, and then suddenly the suppression let off in a changing international environment reveals in retrospect how wrong that previous approach was, and how right now we are to work in an environment of greater openness. And so I think this is why it's so important to continue to encourage in our dialogues with Indonesia in addressing issues like this, to keep things open, to have a detailed knowledge of what's going on in this environment and in other aspects of the political evolution and development in Indonesia, so that we can adequately address them in our policy responses and have really effective dialogue based on empirical evidence, knowledge, true understanding, rather than just shibboleths and, you know, false beliefs based on ideology or other non-empirical bases. So I do, on behalf of the Department of Foreign Affairs, and I do have a speech which goes in at length to the detail of our foreign policy and CT cooperation with Indonesia, which I won't read out today. Suffice it to say that our CT cooperation with Indonesia is extensive, and I think something of which we are rightly proud in terms of our engagement with Indonesian authorities. But nonetheless, I won't go into that further today. Suffice it to say that I think material like this, the work of researchers, the work of specialists, such as yourself, Sola, are tremendously valuable, and we look forward in the future to further gaining insights from this and from you and from your colleagues as we continue to build the open, transparent and hopefully consolidated and strengthened democracy that we all hope Indonesia to be in the 21st century. Thank you.
Thanks, Alistair. As I mentioned at the outset, this book began in a fit of enthusiasm in Indonesia with Sydney over a beer and then over an orange juice with Sola. But enthusiasm is not enough. You need to actually be able to kind of carry it out. And there we got extremely lucky in that just at the moment when we decided to do this project, Dave McRae joined the Institute as our Indonesia specialist. And I remember going to Dave's office and saying to him, look, I've got this idea, do you want to translate it? And I didn't know Dave that well at this point. And Dave, for those that know him, Dave is not the most excitable character in the world. And what struck me was Dave's great calmness when I told him, well, wouldn't it be good if you could translate Sola's book? And I took that for kind of confidence that this was going to be a relatively easy task for him, having never actually seen the Indonesian book myself. Now, for those of you that have seen the Indonesian book, you'll know that it's about 120,000 words. Dave's translation has been described to me, and I think it is heroic. It took a long number of months. It took a little bit longer than we thought, Dave. Dave was doing it in some very interesting places, I think on a boat at one stage off the Indonesian coast. But we did get there in the end, and I think it's a great testament to his intelligence and to his skill as an Indonesianist. And I would love for my Arabic to be as good as Dave's Indonesian. It's a real credit to him. And he is a great credit to the Lowy Institute. We're very lucky to have him. So I'd like to bring Dave to the lectern, and Dave will also then be introducing our author, Sola.
Thanks, everyone, for coming this evening and to celebrate with us the publication of Sola Houdin's very impressive book, The Roots of Terrorism in Indonesia. I think we've all heard about Sola Houdin's unique qualities and the unique quality of his work from the previous speakers, so I won't go over that again, but just to give an idea of the standing of his Indonesian original, when we began to hint over Twitter that the English version of his book was coming out soon, had someone get in touch and say it was great because he'd had the Indonesian version for some time, but he didn't speak Indonesian and so couldn't read it. And so now he'd be able to access the work. And so for me personally, having known and worked with Sola for a long time, and for the Lowy Institute as a whole, we're delighted to be able to introduce Sola Houdin's work to an English-speaking audience in accordance with the Lowy Institute's broader focus on Indonesia. And we're delighted also that the book will get, I think, the global audience that it deserves. Because in addition to the Uni of New South Wales Press edition that we're launching tonight, I can tell you that Cornell University Press and the National University of Singapore Press will also be doing editions for North America and Europe and Southeast Asia, respectively. So that's a great delight, and I think, Sola, you can be very proud indeed of your work and the results. As I said, I won't say very much at all about Sola or the book. I would just say that I would commend it to all of you. To one of the really fascinating aspects for me translating it, as well as reading it before that, was just the picture it gives of the mindset of jihadis over the decades in Indonesia, and the way that they've reinterpreted each setback that they've suffered, often punishing setbacks, as a necessary step on the path to victory, or a correctable mistake in ideology or tactics, with the result that someone has found a reason to attempt to regenerate anew the movement in each of its successive reincarnations over the past 50 to 60 years. And I think Solo, through his really extensive use of primary materials, gives a very rich sense of that process in the book. And so before I ask Solo up to the lectern, I'll just say a few quick words of thanks. First, to Sydney Jones for her input on the translation and editing, and also to Greg Philly for her, Greg Philly for his, I should say, input on the translation. To Anthony, of course, for editing. Solo for his collaboration throughout the process. And also to DFAT, as well as UNSW Press, for making the publication of the book possible. So without further ado, I'll now ask Solo to come up and say a few words.
Thank you all for coming to this book launch. Actually, I never imagined that my book would be translated into English, let alone launch in Canberra, where I once spent many months, actually in 1999, working as grape picker in the vineyard here near Gungahlin area. This book could not have been translated and published without the help of many people, including Bill Peterson, Anthony Bubalo, Dave McRae, Sydney John, Pak Greg, DFAT, Lowy Institute, and New South Wales Uni Press. And I have to say special word of thanks to my old boss, Gareth Evans, who was supportive from the beginning. Terima kasih, Pak Gareth. Let me start with the few statistics. Indonesia had some serious bombing during Suharto days, but it faced the biggest problem from terrorism after 1999, when interreligious conflict between Muslim and Christian began in Ambon in eastern Indonesia. According to police data between 2000 and 2013, there have been some 289 acts of terrorism. Everything from actual attack to plot and threats. This attack, from church bombing to shooting the police to the colossal attack like Bali bombing, have killed more than 345 people. In the same period, more than 800 suspected terrorists have been arrested, and more than 95% of the terrorists have identified themselves as Islamist activists who believe that terrorist attacks are legitimate acts of jihad. Because of this, we have to acknowledge that terrorism in Indonesia is religiously motivated. To be honest, when this book was written, many Indonesians still believed that terrorism had no connection to religious teaching. Religion, in this case, being Islam, it was difficult for Muslim leaders in Indonesia to admit that terrorism was linked to particular understanding of religion. And some commentators in Indonesia and also some politicians in Indonesia were worried about making the link for fear of offending the Muslim community. For me, this kind of attitude is completely unhealthy. It means we don't want to understand what's wrong. When we refuse to admit that the problem lies in ourselves, it means we look for outsiders to blame. One thing that made me really want to write this book was that I wanted to take on people like this that I saw as apologies for violence. For me, the facts were clear that terrorism was linked to particular understanding of religion, because we could read the books that terrorists themselves wrote. Look at the writing of Bali bombing like Imam Samudra or Mukhlas, who are always quoting the Quran and Hadith and then explain their meaning in way that justifying murdering civilians such as women, children, and old people. This kind of understanding, in my view, goes totally against the understanding of Islam followed by most Indonesians, for whom it is forbidden to shed the blood of women, children, and the elderly. But the Bali bomber acknowledged that they followed the ideology of Salafi jihadism, the same ideology promoted by Al-Qaeda. In my book, I try to understand how Indonesians come to adopt this way of thinking. I look at various cases of violence in the name of religion that had taken place in Indonesia. One finding was that this kind of Al-Qaeda understanding and teaching were nothing new in Indonesia. They had been around since the 40s. The term Salafi jihadism had not appeared, but there were teachings that justified acts of terror, including killing of vulnerable civilians like women and children. The group that promoted this teaching was Darul Islam, or Negara Islam Indonesia, a rebellion group that wanted to establish an Islamic state in Indonesia. If we look at the history of violence in the name of religion in Indonesia, we see that most of it was carried out by people linked to Darul Islam. For example, Komando Jihad in the 70s, Terror Warman in early 80s, the Borobudur bombing in 1985, the mini rebellion in Talang Sari, Lampung in 1989, and many others. Even Jemaah Islamiyah was a splinter group of Darul Islam. Even today, many of acts of terror are linked to DI member. Between 2010 and 2013, for example, there were 50 terrorism cases that involved either active or former member of DI. If you want to know more about the history of jihadi movement in Indonesia, you can read my book. But there is also one message I want to convey. Ideology is important. In this book, I look at the history of ideology behind the terrorist movement in Indonesia, from teaching of Darul Islam in the 40s and 50s through its metamorphosis to Salafi jihadism in the 90s. We cannot understand terrorism without understanding the ideology that justified it. One characteristic of all Islamist jihadi group is that every act of terrorism must be rooted in Islamic law, at least the Salafi jihadi interpretation of it. Some people, for example, wonder, for example, why terrorists in Indonesia seem to have abandoned the far enemy, the US and its allies, like Australia, for example. And now, the terrorists have made the near enemy, Indonesian government, their number one target. This shift cannot be explained without reference to the popularity in Indonesia of the teaching of the Jordanian-Palestinian scholar Muhammad al-Maqdisi. Al-Maqdisi criticized many acts of terrorism that are only aimed at weakening the enemy. He believed that jihad, including terrorist attack, can only be carried out with a view toward the victory of the Muslim community, as evident by establishing of an Islamic state. So this idea, the idea actually better chance of producing an Imarah Islam or an Islamic state than the previous idea, now has been picked up by the global jihadi movement, even within Al-Qaeda. It makes attack on the near enemy far more important, because the real obstacle to establishing an Islamic state are local officials who refuse to apply Islamic law. The popularity of Maqdisi concept made the idea attack on the foreigner far less popular, which is one reason why today we see less targeting of the far enemy by Indonesian terrorists. Here another example. A few weeks back, I met with an official from BNPT, Anti-Terrorism National Body. He claimed that the radicalization program for terrorist prisoners was relatively successful. The evidence he used was the fact that dozens of prisoners were willing to sign statements that they were loyal to Pancasila and the Indonesian government. But people who don't understand Salafi jihadism can be mistaken in this kind of assessment. If we understand the jihadist way of thinking, we have to wonder if they have really changed. Salafi jihadism have different opinion about their colleagues in prison. One is that being in prison is kind of emergency situation that allow you to lie, even to the point of expressing non-belief in the faith. Others believe that one principle of war is deception, and that in war, and that in any warlike situation, you are permitted to lie. Now most of the terrorist prisoners see prison as one of those emergency where they can say anything the government want to hear about loyalty to Pancasila and the Indonesian state. It doesn't mean they believe it or that they have changed. It's rather that they believe they are in a state of war that requires behavior to deceive their capture. Just before I close, I would like to explain that the ideology of Salafi jihadism is a moral system, but an unstable one. It was founded by Abdullah Azam and his friend in the 1980s at the time of the war against the Soviet in Afghanistan. In other words, it is still young as ideologies go. From time to time, ideology undergo correction and new teaching emerge, usually in the response to the security situation or political development. We can see, for example, how one Salafi teaching has become particularly popular this day, the idea of individual jihad. It means you no longer have to have commander and large organization to wage war, but you can undertake jihad with a couple of friends or even by yourself. The idea of individual jihad emerged as response to the pressure that larger group were under, that led to the fragmentation of the jihadi movement. In the 80s and 90s, no one had heard about individual jihad, but as Salafi jihadism changed to adapt to new situation, its principle also changed. We have to be alert to ideological change because they can result in new understanding of tactics and targets. For me, understanding the ideology and teaching of Salafi jihadism is the key to understanding the phenomenon of terrorism in Indonesia. With this, I will stop and just say, hope you enjoy the book. Thank you.
Thanks, Sola. That brings our proceedings tonight to an end. Please stay around and mingle if you like. There are some plates from the book. If you want Sola to sign them, he'll be very pleased to do that. There are some order forms. Again, apologies for not having the copy of the book here, but I'm sure it will be in the co-op bookshop within a matter of days. Final thanks to the Australian National University for hosting us tonight, in particular to Greg Feely and to Kerry Hogan, who did a fantastic job of pulling everything together and organising the logistics. So thank you very much, Kerry.